From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This week, Eric Clapton swept the Grammys with his album Unplugged. So we thought you'd enjoy listening back to a 1989 interview with Clapton in which he talked about his early romance with the blues and his work with the Yardbirds and Cream. Also today, rock critic Ken Tucker tells us about the debut album by the new vocal group Shy. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Falling Down, the new Everyman movie starring Michael Douglas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The New York City Medical Examiner now says at least 5 people were killed and more than 200 injured in an explosion today under one of the twin towers of the World Trade Center. Reporter Steve Inskeep has details.
Thousands of accountants and stockbrokers have staggered out of the World Trade Center, their faces covered in black smoke after walking down 30 or 40 or even 107 flights of stairs to safety.
We're on the 36th floor, and we heard the blast
explosion, and a building just
shook, and the lights went out, and it was like thunder, more than thunder, just lightning that hit the building, and just everything was shaken. I mean, it's scary. It was scary.
The explosion took place in a train station underneath New York's tallest building. Some people were trapped in rubble from a ceiling collapse, and the search for victims continues. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep in New York.
Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly confirmed that there was a call claiming responsibility, but he offered no details as to its nature. Kelly also refused to confirm that there was a bomb. Later bomb threats caused police to shut down the Empire State Building and 26 Federal Plaza, the building housing the New York headquarters of the FBI. The NBC television affiliate in New York reported that the city's airports have also been placed on security alert because of police suspicions that the explosion was caused by a bomb. Los Angeles teachers have voted to accept salary cuts rather than go on strike against the nation's second-largest school district. Teachers' Union President Helen Bernstein said the results ran about 2-1 in favor of a compromise that would reduce teacher pay. Bernstein said the compromise plan wasn't acceptable to anyone, but it was more acceptable than a lengthy strike. The union represents 32,000 teachers, nurses, and counselors. The compromise imposes a 10% pay cut on union members. President Clinton called for improved relations among the world's industrialized countries in a speech today at American University. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
We must compete, not retreat, President Clinton said this morning, signaling to those who've been predicting an all-out trade war that he instead strongly opposes protectionism. The president called on Germany and Japan to do more for the global economy by opening markets to foreign goods. But he said the United States must set an example by building a strong economy and reaching outward at the same time.
I say that if we set a new direction at home, we can set a new direction for the world as well.
The finance ministers and central bank governors of the 7 major industrial powers are meeting this weekend in London. Trade and aid to Russia are on the agenda for discussion. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained about 6 points today to close at 3,370. This is NPR. Japan's 2 biggest domestic and international telephone companies announced massive job cuts today as their business feels the effects of Japan's continuing recession. The Nippon Telegraph and Telephone Company said it will eliminate 33,000 jobs by early 1997. Japan's largest international telecommunications company also said it will cut about 850 jobs, or almost 15% of its workforce. The cuts mark a serious turnaround for Japan, where most companies have traditionally offered lifetime employment to their workers. The Clinton administration has made a decision about the future of 2 key health officials who were holdovers from the Bush administration. NPR's Joe Palca has a report.
David Kessler will stay on as head of the Food and Drug Administration, but Bernadine Healy will leave her post as director of the National Institutes of Health. Healey became a target of congressional Democrats because of her active support for the Bush administration's ban on federal funding for certain kinds of fetal tissue research. In one of his first acts after taking office, President Clinton lifted the ban. Although Kessler took some controversial stands, an administration source says the president was confident in Kessler's leadership at FDA and asked him to stay. As presidential appointees, both Healey and Kessler were slated to lose their jobs in January when President Bush left office. But both won a last-minute reprieve when the president-elect asked Mr. Bush to tear up their resignations. For Healey, that reprieve will end June 30th when her resignation takes effect. In Washington, I'm Joe Palca.
The Washington, D.C. bank that was once illegally owned by the Bank of Credit and Commerce International will be sold to a North Carolina-based bank holding company. First American Bank shares was under a federal court order to be sold by late June. The bank announced today it will be bought by First Union Corporation for $453 million. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Would you know my name if I saw you in heaven?
Eric Clapton won 6 Grammys at this week's 35th annual ceremony, including Best Album, Single, Rock Song, Male Pop Vocal, and Rock Vocal. The winning album, Unplugged, is the soundtrack of a live MTV performance. The winning song, Tears in Heaven, is in memory of his 4-year-old son who fell to his death from an apartment window. Today we're going to hear an interview I recorded with Eric Clapton back in 1989. We discussed everything from his early years in the British blues scene to his status as one of the first guitar heroes. When he was young, he was inspired by black blues performers. He told me how he discovered their music.
When I was a little boy of about 9 years old, I think I heard a couple of records on the radio just being slotted in different variety programs that were by blues musicians from America. One was quite popular, actually, in England. It was called Whooping and Hollering by Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. And it was an instrumental thing with harmonica and guitar and country blues, really, fast country blues. And then I heard also Big Bill Brunzi, who was quite popular in Europe during the 50s and early 60s, and a fantastic guitar player and a great folk artist, you know. And I was, I don't know why, I was immensely attracted to the sound. I was immensely attracted to the spirit of the music. And I decided to kind of examine it, investigate. And so I became a blues collector, as a, you know, buying export blues records at export shops. And I got finally into people like Muddy Waters and Robert Johnson and all of the country blues players, and that's really where I got all my influences from to begin with.
Did you teach yourself guitar?
Yes, there was no one else interested in the kind of thing I was interested in. It was a very strange, unique phenomena that I was probably one of about 4 or 5 people in England, I guess, that at the time that were interested in that particular kind of music. So it was quite lonely, but I was dedicated to it. I loved that music, and I wanted to play it.
What were some of the greatest frustrations of being self-taught?
Not really knowing that, for instance, when you pick up a 6-string guitar, and I didn't know how to tune it, you know. I mean, just basically didn't know how to tune it. And I refused, you know, I mean, a quite arrogant way to buy the books, you know, buy even those Teach Yourself How to Play Basic Guitar books. So I had to learn how to tune the guitar on my own.
And those books had awful songs.
Well, yeah, that's what, you know, Old Black Joe was the kind of...
Exactly, yeah.
Obligatory kind of songs. I couldn't stand that stuff, and I refused to do it any other way but my own way. And then the next step was, once, if you considered you had got it in tune, was that if you put your fingers on different frets and then tried to make a chord, I was under the impression I was inventing all this stuff, you see, and... In actual fact, it was all being done before, but it was a great... I prefer to think of doing it that way because I felt like I was discovering it all.
You were learning the blues as a white Englishman, and you were very removed from the lives of the bluesmen whose music you were emulating. Was there an element of romance in your mind to what the blues musician's life was? And did you know anybody who was remotely like the musicians whose work you were listening to and trying to play?
I didn't know anybody at all that I could identify with in that way. But to the first part of your question was that, yes, it was incredibly romantic. I could identify in some aspects in that I came from a very poor country background. And so, that I mean, I was kind of maybe like a white counterpoint of in the English South, you know, except there wasn't a racial situation at all. But we were very poor, and it was like, you know, it was, I imagine it'd be quite similar to somewhere in Mississippi. I don't, maybe not, but I tend to identify with it in that way. And I kind of dreamt of myself being this this lonesome blues singer, you know, at a very early age.
Do you remember the first time you actually performed with a black blues musician?
I think it would have been Sonny Boy Williamson. Yeah, and I was already in a professional band called the Yardbirds. I was around 18 years old, and Sonny Boy had just done a tour with the Country Blues Festival through Europe, and he decided that he would like to stay in England and make some money, because it was possible then for blues performers like himself to go through Europe and make an incredible amount of money, which is more than they could dream of making in America. And the Yardbirds were somehow linked up with him through the management people to do a tour of England. And I met him and was incredibly scared of him. He was a very, very, a frightening man. I mean, a very nice man, but he had an attitude that he could adopt at any point where that was really quite terrifying. Apart from that, musically, he was so inspiring that it was the first taste I had of the real thing, you know.
And what was your reaction to it?
My reaction was very mixed. First of all, I think you get into this. I was very possessive about the blues, and I thought that being that I was one of the only people playing it in England, I tended to think that I owned it around that time in my life. And to meet someone who was real doing it made me feel a little bit ashamed. A little bit possessive and a little bit resentful about the whole situation, and all mixed up at the same time with overawe, you know. And the whole thing sort of seemed very bewildering to me as a phenomenon, you know. It was a bewildering experience.
You know, you use the word playing with someone who was real. It makes me think that you thought of yourself as not real, not...
Well, it was a bit of a kind of phony situation when you think about it. I was English, I was white, and I was dedicated to and playing the blues, or what I thought were the blues, but it was all in an unreal situation, and all derived from records that I bought or listening to the radio, and quite contrived, really. And I deliberately was trying to live what I assumed would be a blues man's lifestyle, you know, bumming around with a guitar on my shoulder. And to meet the real thing, who was... And see, Sonny Boy blew a lot of the myth away by being incredibly interested in money and women. And, you know, I had set myself up to think that, you know, a blues man was far, far above these kind of earthly pursuits. You know, I thought that it was much, you know, a blues man would be dedicated to his music and nothing else would matter. And it really wasn't like that at all. You know, it was all down to flashy suits and fast cars and... you know, the stuff that you like in life. And it really kind of shook me up.
So how did it change you?
Well, I guess I started to adopt a lot of those attitudes myself, you know, at a fairly early age. And musically, it meant that I had to get my act together, you know, because... I think that what happened with the Yardbirds was that I was one of the only ones that wanted to. The rest of the guys were... We were all a little bit intimidated by Sonny Boy, but I think the others were more than I was. You know, I was attracted as well as intimidated, and I wanted, after that, to carry on in that lifestyle, and that the others wanted really to go in a pop music direction.
We're featuring a 1989 interview with Eric Clapton. He swept the Grammys Wednesday night with his song Tears in Heaven and his album Unplugged. Let's get back to his days with the Yardbirds. This was their first hit, For Your Love, which came out in 1965.
For your love. right to your door.
For your love.
To thrill you with delight. I'll give you diamonds bright. There'll be days that will excite and make you dream of me at night.
Early in your career with the group The Yardbirds and playing a mix of blues and pop, and you left the group after the band really started to get a big hit, which was For Your Love. And
yeah.
My understanding is that you left because you thought that the song was too pop and that the group was getting more commercial and going away from its blues emphasis. I wonder what you think listening back to that record now. I mean, I think it's a really good record, whether it's whether it's blues or not.
Yeah, I think it's a good record. If I hadn't been part of the band, I thought I probably would have liked it then too, but it seemed to me a huge threat at the time. And
I thought because it was taking you away from what you wanted to do?
Well, a very big disappointment, you know, because it was kind of like going out with a girl and then finding out that, you know, that she likes, I don't know, you know, Sly Stallone when you like Robert De Niro. Do you know what I mean? It's got, all your tastes suddenly start to diverge, and it was... It was heartbreaking. It was really, actually, very heartbreaking, and one of the first real big disappointments in my life. Because to start out with, the band was very unified in our likes and dislikes, and then I noticed that they became more kind of interested in what the, you know, Freddie and the Dreamers were wearing on stage and things like that. So I don't know. It just really floored me, and for a while after I left that band, I really considered packing it all in because I didn't think anyone else, you know, cared about it the way I did.
What did you do when you left the band?
I went and stayed with a friend of mine in Oxford. He's a friend of mine who was a pianist first and then became a woodcarver. And he had left the band and he was carving a Tang horse as a method of sort of his way of retaliating against the rest of the band. And we sat up in Oxford and just drank wine and ate pigeon pie for about 3 or 4 months. And then John Mayall got in touch with me and asked me if I'd join his band.
Well, you joined John Mayall with the Blues Breakers, and the emphasis there really was on authenticity and on playing as closely to, you know, the blues records that inspired you as you could get. Was that a satisfying experience?
Yes, it was. I really enjoyed working with John, and I now kind of regret that I left the band so early because we'd only made one record, really, which later on seemed to become a classic, and I think it's a classic record. It would have been nice to have furthered it a bit more, and I know he'll agree with me with that, but I guess I was young and impetuous, and I wanted to go my own way. You know, I found my feet so fast with John's band that it seemed like the world was my oyster, you know.
Let's listen to one of the Blues Breakers records. My guest Eric Clapton sings and plays guitar on this one. This is the Robert Johnson song, Ramblin' on My Mind.
I'm going down to the station, catch that old fast milk train, see. I'm going down to the station, catch that old fast milk train, see. The blues about Miss Sonson, and the sun got the blues about me.
After the Blues Breakers with John Mayall, you formed Cream with Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker, and you've said that you liked Jack Bruce's irreverence, that you liked him for not trying to be authentic, a bluesman.
Yeah, he came in from another area altogether, and he was one of the first musicians that was... And Ginger too, but Jack, in a much more easily identifiable way, was a rebel, musical rebel. You know, he came from a jazz background, and it was one of the... He was like one of the first fusion players I'd ever met who was willing to cross jazz into blues and rock and roll all at the same time. He didn't see that there was a musical boundary. And he was a very intellectual, one of the first musical intellectuals that I met. He was deeply into classical music and modern classical music at that. And I was, for quite a while, under Jack's spell, because he seemed to me to have, you know, the most unique and avant-garde attitude towards music that I'd ever met.
What did Cream bring out in your playing that you hadn't expressed before?
Freedom, I think. During the time that I was with Cream, I was constantly being urged by Jack and Ginger to kind of throw off all of my inhibitions that I'd spent years honing with the Blues Breakers, for instance, and my blues rule book was supposed to be going out the window, and it often did. You know, when we played live more than any other time, we would simply just improvise, and it would be very hard for me, more than anyone else, to really get rid of my idea of frameworks and structures. You know, I was really the last one to be able to let go of the things that I'd been using to hold me down up until then.
We're featuring a 1989 interview with Eric Clapton. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Eric Clapton won 6 Grammys Wednesday night, so we're rebroadcasting an interview I did with him 3 years ago. Here he is with Cream, jamming on Crossroads, the Robert Johnson blues classic that Cream turned into a rock hit. What was it like for you to learn to take sustained solos in concerts? Were you used to doing that before Cream?
Yes, I think we did it with... I think John would encourage me to play as long as I liked, but I had a much more controlled idea about what it should be then. With Cream, it came out of a very basic kind of necessity situation. The first gig we ever played at a big jazz festival in England, we ran out of material after about an hour, and the crowd wanted more, and they weren't going to give up, and so we literally had to go and jam, and we found that became the most popular part of our act, was when we didn't have anything set to play, and we would just play off the top of our heads, and it worked. A lot of the time it really worked.
I'm wondering if there were times at concerts when everyone in the band was really high and nearly everybody in the audience was really high, and it would lead to this almost self-indulgent, you know, length in solos. Did you ever feel that way?
Yeah, I can remember playing at the Fillmore many times, at Fillmore West, when, you know, it was just like being in someone's front room with everyone smashed out of their brains listening to the stereo, and we were the stereo, really.
So was that a good feeling or an alienating feeling?
Well, I'm not going to pretend it was anything but great.
Okay,
I mean, I thought it was fantastic.
My guest is Eric Clapton. Why don't we listen to the opening of one of Cream's best-known records?
I'll soon be with you, my love. Give you my dawn surprise.
On something like Sunshine of Your Love, which has this now really famous opening lick. Do you consider that part of the composition, or is that something that was added afterwards, and who came up with that?
Well, that's Jack. We went to see Jimi Hendrix. Jimi was a dear friend of ours, and this was like 1967. There was a theatre in London called the Savile Theatre where everyone at the time was playing, and we went to see Jimi play there, and Jack and I were in a box looking down, and I think it was the first time Jack had really listened to Jimi properly, you know, and he was overwhelmed, and that night he went home and wrote that riff, and the song was actually written on the riff. It wasn't added, you know, that wasn't the... It was the other way around from the way that you think. You know, we didn't add the riff to the song. We added the song to the riff.
And Crossroads, which is one of the Cream records that I think you must have initiated. It's a Robert Johnson song that I'm sure it was you who decided to record. You do the vocal on it. It was one of the few Cream records that you were the solo singer
on. Yeah.
Tell me why you wanted to record that.
I'd had the Robert Johnson album for many years by then, and I was pretty well familiar with all of the songs on there, and I thought that was the best one. I mean, I always wanted to do Robert Johnson's songs in different... I mean, the first one I did was with John Mayall. I did Rambling on My Mind, and...
Which you sang also, yeah.
Yeah, but then with Cream, each time we made a record, I would find some way of arranging a Robert Johnson song to put on there. But Crossroads, to me, was the one that summed up... I didn't know it then, but I guess it must have summed me up in many ways, but it summed up Robert Johnson's story, you know.
How do you think it summed up your story?
Because I've been at that crossroads many times in my life in many different ways, musically, personally, business-wise, just geographically. I'm often at that place, and I kind of follow my own nose. I don't really know where I'm going a lot of the time.
What did the whole Clapton is God period have on you? What effect did it have on you when people were writing that kind of graffiti on walls?
Well, I don't think I actually ever saw it. You know, isn't that the funny thing? I don't think...
Is this all apocryphal? I mean, I can swear I've seen it.
I've only ever heard it said, and I've seen a picture of a wall in London. And it's a funny picture. There's this brick wall in London with Clapton is God written on it in white, chalk or paint, I don't know what. And at the bottom of the picture, there's a dog peeing against the wall. You know? And that kind of sums up my attitude towards it. But I don't think I've ever actually seen it in the flesh. So it's all something that I've had to accept from other people. And as far as that goes, it's a bit like someone kind of paying you the highest compliment they can think of. And in that respect, I've tried to learn to accept it graciously.
Mm-hmm.
First of in the early days, I would just I was thoroughly disgusted with the whole thing. But as time has gone by, I've learned to say thank you.
Eric Clapton recorded on Fresh Air in 1989. I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air, and we'll be back with more from Eric Clapton in the second half of our show. Here's Clapton's classic hit, Layla.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Eric Clapton was one of the first guitar heroes. This week, his Unplugged album swept the Grammys. Coming up, the second part of our 1989 interview with Clapton, focusing on his life and work after he left Cream. Also, Rockford & Ken Tucker reviews If I Ever Fall in Love, the album with the hit single of the same name by the new vocal group Shy. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Falling Down, the new movie starring Michael Douglas about one man's revenge against the system. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. At least five people were killed and more than 200 others were injured today when an underground explosion occurred beneath the World Trade Center in New York City. Police now believe the cause of that explosion was a bomb. Thousands of people were forced to flee down smoke-filled stairs when power went out in the 110-story building. More than 6 hours after the explosion, officials said all but about 80 people had been evacuated. And some of those who had been inside the building at the time of the blast voiced their alarm.
We heard like a big shaking, and everybody got kind of nervous. The power went out for a second, came back on, and we were kind of confused for a while, and then we made it down the stairs.
It sounded like a bomb, then it sounded like something was falling, but it felt like an earthquake because everything was shaking.
Right.
We were frightened.
I was eating lunch at a grand concourse level, and the explosion went off, and everyone had dropped their sandwiches, their sodas, and evacuated. They panicked. They didn't know what it was.
Well, I was on the 25th floor, and I had to go down, and then they asked us to go up again. It was just awful, and I was very lucky to be alive.
Officials in New York City closed the Empire State Building early as a precaution after receiving a threat. There have been several claims of responsibility in connection with today's explosion at the World Trade Center, but there has been no confirmation as yet. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has urged NATO allies to step up their efforts to halt the fighting and bloodshed in the Balkans. In a speech today to Alliance foreign ministers in Brussels, Christopher said that Washington would take part in peace efforts, but with the expectation that Europe will play a leading role. Jan Ziff has more from Brussels.
Christopher told the NATO foreign ministers Washington would participate fully in the implementation of any agreement that preserved Bosnia as a state, but he urged the alliance to do more to find a solution to the crisis. U.S. participation comes with the expectation that Europe, which is most directly affected, will play a leading role and redouble its concerted efforts, he said, noting that the addition of the United States should certainly not occasion any relaxation by others. Although Christopher said he hadn't gone to Brussels to get NATO to participate in President Clinton's plan to airdrop humanitarian supplies into Bosnia, it's understood NATO airborne surveillance planes will support the U.S. flights. Air Force early warning aircraft are already monitoring the no-fly zone imposed by the United Nations last year. For National Public Radio, I'm Jan Ziff in Brussels.
In Cairo, an explosion at a downtown coffee shop killed two people and injured 16 others. The cause of that explosion is not known. Police say the two people killed were foreigners and that of the shop's customers, many are usually from other countries. Among those wounded were Americans, Germans, and Swedes. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 6 points to close at 3,370. This is NPR News. In Somalia, military officials say that plans are going ahead to pull some 3,000 U.S. troops out of the country, despite rioting and gunfire in the capital over the last 4 days. However, some 1,000 U.S. troops slated to be pulled out of Kismayu will stay there for some time. In factional fighting in the capital, one clan leader accused U.S.-led troops of backing a rival, a charge that U.S. officials denied. There are still some 18,000 troops in the country, and officials hope to transfer security command to the U.N. by April. Teachers in the nation's second-largest school district will not go out on strike Monday. In Los Angeles, teachers have accepted a compromise proposal that still cuts their pay but gives them more control over school and classroom policies. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
The announcement came this afternoon,
Los Angeles teachers have voted to accept the compromise proposal by a margin of more than 2-1. As Teachers Union President Helen Bernstein put it, "I don't think the offer was acceptable to anyone, but it was more acceptable than a lengthy strike." Last December, the financially strapped Los Angeles School District demanded that teachers take a 12% cumulative pay cut. The teachers responded by setting a strike date for earlier this month. Willie Brown, the powerful speaker of the California Assembly, was brought in to mediate a settlement. Ultimately, he offered his own proposal, which cut teacher pay 10%, slightly less than the 12% cut sought by the school district. The school district accepted Willie Brown's proposal, and in voting this week, teachers voted to accept it as well. In Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
General Electric has announced plans to lay off nearly 4,000 workers in its aircraft engines division. The company blamed the new layoffs on cuts in military spending and cutbacks in orders by many commercial airlines. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When Eric Clapton walked away with 6 Grammys this week, we decided to feature our 1989 interview with him. Clapton is one of rock's first guitar heroes and godfather to many heavy metal bands, but his award-winning album Unplugged is an acoustic concert originally broadcast on MTV. This second part of our interview begins with his last days in Cream, the band he formed in the mid-60s with bassist and singer Jack Bruce and drummer Ginger Baker. Let's get back to our 1989 interview.
A couple of years ago, you did an interview with Robert Palmer for, I guess it was in the New York Times. Maybe it was in Rolling Stone. New York Times? Okay. And you had told him that John Landau had written a review of a Cream concert.
That's right.
And he gave it a really bad review. And you said that the Ring of Truth knocked you backwards, and that's when you decided that you wanted to leave Cream. Why did that review have such a profound effect on you?
Well, it was tied in with a long, in-depth interview which I had done in Sausalito. If my memory serves me right, I had been flying high, and we'd been playing the film where we're stoned and everything. And really, we were God's gift to music, you know, and I was blathering on about all this. And on the next page was this fantastic review, and I was summed up as being the master of the cliché. And juxtaposed with this interview, the effect was astonishing. And I remember reading the article in a restaurant. I was with some friends in Boston, and I read the whole thing in silence, and the other guys were just sitting around having a conversation. I stood up to go to the loo and passed out. I mean, it had that severe. And I remember waking up, not coming around in the restaurant. I was taken, carried out of the restaurant and put in someone's house, and waking up thinking, what the hell is going on? And immediately thinking, I've got to get out of this. You know, that whole thing was right. And I've been playing this awful game. A musical game for too long, and I've got to leave that band and this and that and plan a new life. It had a devastating effect on me.
Was it because you were embarrassed, insulted, or because you felt that you needed to be moving in a new musical direction?
The last part is what... I mean, I was ashamed because I think inside I had known for quite a while that we were really... we were selling the audiences short, you know. We were going on stage stoned, and we were playing just kind of meaningless, a lot of the time anyway, meaningless, endless solos, and people were swallowing it. And I was starting to feel rather ashamed of the whole thing because we were resting on our laurels, to say the least. You know, we weren't sitting down thinking about new ways to write songs or developing the music of the band. We had got stuck in a rut by that point.
Mm-hmm. So you did leave Cream because of that?
Yes, I did. I mean, I said to the guys, I've got to leave. You know, I've got to do something else or just stop. You know, I don't want to do this anymore. And I think we'd approached this situation for other reasons before. You know, we were constantly having rows about one thing or another. And then we talked to the manager about it, and he decided we should do one farewell tour, you know, and make a farewell album, which is what we did. And at that point, actually, funnily enough, as it does happen in many other walks of life, we became suddenly very much closer. And I think during the farewell concert we did at the Albert Hall, there was a great deal of regret and nostalgia on my part, and I wasn't sure if I was doing the right thing.
Looking back, what do you think?
Yes, I think I'd... Now, after all this time, I think I had a lot of other things to do that I couldn't have done if I'd stayed with that band.
You, not too long after that, I guess, formed Blind Faith. I think for the first Blind Faith concert, there was like an audience of 36,000. What was it like for you to go from starting off playing in small clubs and ending up playing these huge concerts, you know, stadium concerts? It's quite a transition, and it was right at the very beginning of that period where concerts got that big. I mean, so it's not something you could have been expecting.
I think we were sort of lulled into a full sense of security there. I think we assumed that this particular concert we did was going to be a one-off. You know, then we would go back to clubs, or at least it would be interspersed. You know, we were probably going to do, in our minds anyway, you know, big halls now and then mainly clubs. But of course, halfway through the American tour, the whole thing started to get very jaded because we were only playing stadiums and we weren't ready. We had... barely enough material to do, you know, an hour and a half. And outside of that, we were empty, you know, and that wasn't the way it wanted to be. We wanted to be, at least Steve and myself, Steve Winwood and myself, wanted to be like a very integral band that could play for hours, you know, and, mm-hmm. and learn lots of songs and just have a whole wealth of material, something that you would take years to develop. And, of course, we never were given that chance.
You eventually took a hiatus from music, and you spent a couple of years doing a lot of drugs.
Yeah, basically doing a lot of drugs. Yeah, I think I can't remember where it started. I've always been I've always had a leaning towards addictions, you know, one way or another, an obsessive personality to say the least. And even when I was 16, everyone, in fact, it was like peer pressure. To everyone was taking amphetamine or different kind, or drinking wine. You know, it was part of life, it seemed to be, to get stoned. And I realised now that I was going to end up, you know, on the heap. And I pretty well got close to that. And during the early 70s, I got as close to killing myself with drugs as I could ever get. And it started out the way it always starts out, you know, smoking a joint or taking a few pills. And for some people, it escalates very quick. For me, it took a long time, but I got there, and I diced with death for a while, and I regret it. That's for sure.
Did you have like a bottoming out moment where you figured this is it? I've got to change.
Yeah, I think it's funny because it's difficult to be. I mean, when you are that stoned, it's difficult to be. To stand outside of yourself and see how far you've gone, you know, because you're so wrapped up in it. Other people can tell you, but it's very difficult for you to see yourself. And it happened to me at some point. I'd had friends come and stay with me, and they were virtually like my jailers, you know. They were making sure that I didn't harm myself. I was taking lots of heroin. I was taking Mandrax, which is a powerful, like a Quaalude equivalent. I was drinking lots of hard liquor. And at some point, I remember seeing myself, and this is true, sitting in my car at dawn, totally naked, trying to start it. And what I was doing, I was trying to escape from my own house where these people were trying to look after me. And it, thank God, one of the guys had taken out the rotor arm of the engine, and I was just sitting there trying to start the car, totally naked. I don't know where I was going to go, but I had a flash then that things had gone a little too far. So I, that was when I decided to kind of start doing something about it.
And what did you do?
I went to an acupuncturist who had set up a practice in London using a fairly revolutionary form of treatment whereby she passed a small electric current from one ear to the other and induced a sort of a mild natural narcosis, which took away the withdrawal symptoms which you get when you're trying to stop taking heroin.
Mm-hmm.
The point was, of course, that I hadn't actually used it. I'd never taken heroin intravenously, so it wasn't that hard a habit for me to kick. It was quite hard, but I did it with the help of this acupuncturist.
Did you ever think that an addiction to drugs, an obsession with drugs, is kind of related to, in a way, the same kind of obsession that allows you to spend as many hours as you must have developing your guitar playing? Do you know what I mean? Because you've been obsessive about guitar playing and about your music.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. I like to think of my guitar, my love for guitar playing, as being dedicated. But it's not far removed from being obsessive. I mean, there's a fine line between those two words. And what happened when I became obsessed with drug taking was that obviously my guitar playing took second place. And you know, one is a natural kind of dedication, and the other one is a very unnatural dedication.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I want to ask you something about your past, about your very beginnings, actually. I know you've talked about this, that your mother had you, she wasn't married, and she left, I think, shortly after you were born, and you were brought up by your grandparents, who told you that they were actually your parents, and when your mother returned, you were told at first that she was your sister. And I'm wondering what effects you think that had on your public identity, do you know what I mean, on your public sense of self,
It's very complicated, isn't it? I mean, whatever the result was, has to be a complicated result, isn't it, when you think about it? I've got so many different sides of my nature as a result of that upbringing. I mean, I think there's a side of me that, you know, dreads rejection, dreads abandonment. There's another side that sort of loves solitude. And I don't know, it's had all kinds of effects on me. Most of which I've kind of started to deal with over the last few years and come to terms with. And if I can, I change parts of my personality that cause me difficulty, or I at least accept them. But for sure, it was an unusual upbringing, you know.
Is your mother still alive?
Yes, she is, and we're great pals. We're more like brother and sister than anything else, because she's... You know, she's not that much older than me, because she was, when I was born, she was 15. And so really the age difference isn't that much. And because we didn't spend time as mother and son when I was young, we're family members, but it's almost difficult to say what kind of family members we are.
Do you call her Ma?
Yeah, I do. I call her Ma, but then sometimes I call her Pat too, which is her name. And It's a funny situation. It's a very loving situation, and it's finally come full circle to where everyone is kind of relaxed about it now.
Mm-hmm. You said that at some point in your career that you got bored with virtuoso musicianship. What was the turning point for you?
Well, I think that might have been a very glib way for me to say that I couldn't get it any better. I actually had reached the end of my capabilities, I think. And a lot of people were taking it further on, so I suppose I had to develop some kind of attitude about it, and it was probably better off for my face to say that I was getting bored, you know.
So after you felt you couldn't take it any further, you wanted to turn to something else?
No, I just realized that technically my potential was probably had come to its end, you know. I'm not that nimble, really. I don't think I can compete on the sort of the fast, furious guitar sort of championships. So I tended to go the other way.
By going the other way, you mean singing more?
Yeah, singing more, or just kind of refining my technique to somewhere where I could simplify it and get more out of it.
I got
with doing less, you know.
Eric Clapton recorded in 1989. He swept the Grammys this week with his album Unplugged and his song Tears in Heaven. This is Fresh Air. One of the most popular songs of the season is If I Ever Fall in Love by a new vocal group called Shai. That's spelled S-H-A-I, and it's a Swahili word that means personification of destiny. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
There are a couple of inescapable hit singles around right now. One of them is Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You from the soundtrack to The Bodyguard, an all-stops-out, in-your-face performance that you either think is profoundly moving or terrifyingly claustrophobic. Guess which I think it is. The other song you can't help but hear every time you pass a radio is Shy's If I Ever Fall in Love, a much more intriguing and satisfying success.
The very first time that I saw your brown eyes, your lips said hello and I said hi. I knew right then
you were the one. But I was caught up in physical attraction, but to my satisfaction, baby, you were more than just a face. And if I
ever fall
in love
again,
I will be
sure that the lady is a friend.
Like you. Oh, yeah.
Shy suggests that you can still become an overnight sensation. This young quartet took a demo tape of this song, a bit of a cappella passion they recorded for a mere $400, to a radio station in Washington, D.C., which played the tune a few times. Response was so strong that If I Ever Fall in Love became first a local hit and then a national one when MCA Records signed them. Shy now has a debut album out, also called If I Ever Fall in Love, and finds itself at the center of a mini-revival of soothing ballad singing, as you can hear in current hits by groups like After Seven, High Five, and Boys to Men. But it's Shy's song that remains the simplest and most striking.
If I say that I could be your one and only,
promise
that you'll never leave me lonely, I just wanna be the one you need. Oh, baby, I just wanna be the one to serve you. Sometimes I feel as if I don't deserve you. I cherish every moment that we share. And if I ever...
The true life showbiz fairy tale surrounding this song is, however, belied by its lyric. Beneath the surging, unadorned harmonies is a collective voice of experience. The narrator has been hurt in love in the past and now pledges that if he ever falls in love again, he'll go with someone who is, quote, a friend. A hit that values personality, commitment, and friendship over one-night stands and physical foxiness? I ask you, what is pop music coming to?
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Ooh, my friend,
very next
I need someone
who
will be
someone
my friend.
Who I can believe.
To be with me,
I'm
thick and thin. Please share my love with me, my friend. I need someone like you. And if I ever...
This is Fresh Air. An explosion in a New York train station whipped through the World Trade Towers today. All things considered, is following the story, and Linda Wertheimer's with us.
We have the New York Bureau on the case, Terry, and we expect to find out as much as we can about an accident in which, so far, we know several people have died and hundreds have been injured. We'll also have a story from Virginia on the new gun law, which has passed there. President Clinton spoke on the global economy at American University today. We'll find out how the Clinton plan will affect rich people, and we'll hear a little bit about CEO compensation, and we'll look into the studies on mammography.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Joel Schumacher began working as a window display artist and then became a costume designer before directing such movies as St. Elmo's Fire, The Lost Boys, Flatliners, and Dying Young. Film critic Stephen Schiff has just seen Schumacher's latest film, Falling Down.
So here's Michael Douglas sitting in an L.A. traffic jam. His forehead is sweaty, his upper lip is sweaty, there's a school bus full of screaming kids right next to him, and besides that, he can't seem to kill the fly that keeps buzzing around his head. Michael Douglas is irritated, real irritated. Irritated the way people are when they shoot at you on the freeway for driving too slowly, or knife you for bumping into them on the street. But what's really scary about Michael Douglas is his look. He's wearing a tie, one of those plastic pocket protectors with pens in it, and a brush cut so terrible that he beats Harrison Ford and Kevin Costner in the nerdy hair sweepstakes hands down. Finally, when he can take it no more, Douglas gets out of his car, leaves it sitting in the traffic, and sets out on foot. He's walking home from Southeast L.A., the worst part of town, to Venice in the West. His first stop is a Korean grocery store, where the shopkeeper refuses to change a dollar so Douglas can phone home. Whereupon Douglas does what any right-minded citizen would do. He grabs the Korean shopkeeper's baseball bat and starts busting up the place. The Korean, of course, thinks he's about to be robbed.
Take the money!
You think I'm a thief? No. You see, I'm not the thief. I'm not the one charging 85 cents for a stinking soda! You're the thief! Just standing up for my rights as a consumer. I'm rolling back prices to 1965. What do you think of that? Donuts. Package of six. How much?
$1.12.
Too much. Double A batteries. Package of four.
$4.29.
Nice try. Well, I think this whole shelf looks suspect.
So begins a rampage that never quite makes the kind of sense director Joel Schumacher thinks it does. As Douglas strides across blasted gangland L.A., he keeps running into minor irritations that make him even madder. And he also keeps acquiring weapons. By the time he reaches the ocean, he's a walking arsenal in the never-ending battle against... well, against what? Fast food places that don't serve breakfast after 11:30, that's what. Unnecessary highway construction projects. Uppity old golfers. The movie makes all Douglas's targets as marginal and as outlandishly annoying as possible, so that we'll feel gratified when he threatens them or blows them away. After all, they've annoyed us too. Wouldn't we have just loved to have, say, a bazooka in hand last time we were stuck in a bank line? Well, perhaps. But as the movie trundles on, it gradually becomes clear that the icy, dislikable character Douglas plays is a psycho, pure and simple. Laid off from his defense industry job, divorced from his improbably lovely wife, played by Barbara Hershey, and now armed and on the loose, just like one of those creeps who gets fired from the post office and returns the next week to blow everyone to smithereens. Falling Down is dying to be a movie like Network, the sort of inky black comedy that makes weighty statements about contemporary ills. But it plays more like a peevish right-wing vigilante fantasy, and a pointless one at that. Falling Down isn't any kind of dark satire. It's Death Wish with a pocket protector.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the electric chair, the gas chamber, and the lethal injection machine. We talk about the technology of execution with Stephen Trombley, author of the new book, The Execution Protocol, Inside America's Capital Punishment Industry. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.